We're going to be talking this morning about Medicare, health insurance, life insurance, and so on after retirement. But before I get into that, I wanted to ask you a question about something Joyce and I were discussing at dinner last night. How many of you women have any credit record established in your own name? Okay, a few of you do. That's good. Those of you who don't may want to give that some serious consideration. Because if you live longer than your husband and you have no credit record established in your name, you have no separate income, you could really have some difficulty. I was talking a few weeks ago with my secretary, who is a widow, and asked her if that had been a problem for her when her husband died, and she said it hadn't, because she had separate earnings, for many, many years, most of her adult life, except during the years her children were small. But for those of you who do not have any credit in your own name and who do not have separate earnings, I would encourage you to get a couple of credit cards in your own name and use them. You know, don't just get a credit card in your name and put it in the drawer, because that doesn't establish a credit record. Using the credit card will. And if you're unable to get one in your own name, you might see about getting a name on one or two of your accounts changed from the husband's name to the wife's name. Because if you're alone and you need to rent a car, you need a credit card. To my knowledge, it's not possible to rent a car these days without a credit card. It's difficult to cash checks without a credit card of some kind. And so on. Yes.
I have a question. If a wife is going to do that, if she doesn't have income or salary, mm-hmm. then how do you, I mean, when they begin to check, you know, can you pay the bill?
Well, I think that what you would do in that case is give your husband's income and indicate that he's the wage earner. And then if they will not issue a card, then see if you can get the name changed on something to your own name.
Like on MasterCard, I mean, that's both names? Or
well, we have both names on some of our cards. Is that sufficient, or does it still be
counted? No, because the bill still comes with your name, doesn't it?
Yeah,
even though we both have cards, the bill comes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But whose name is the account in?
Bank or whatever, to have it put in your name instead of his, as far as the will is concerned. They probably do that.
Well, I would say, first of the week, I bought a small item in here.
Uh-huh. I've heard of others who've had that same difficulty. Yeah. With your name, yes. That kind of thing is becoming less of a problem. But, you know, financial institutions are rather heartless critters. And they don't care if your husband has paid his bills all of his life. They want to know if you're going to pay your bills. And if you have already shown that you can do that, during his lifetime, that will help you down the road. Okay, let's go on to life insurance. There's nothing, excuse me.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
If that would be the case, and wife would apply for credit, would not a financial statement be probably the best approach to ensuring that she didn't get pregnant?
It could be, yes. It would certainly help.
And that's what bank wants.
Uh-huh. Your point is, if you do it before the husband should die, it's extremely difficult to get after the husband is gone. It's just, Linda found that out. It's just extremely difficult to get any credit in yourself.
Even though you got like a MasterCard in both of your names.
Well, she actually had started, for just again, gone to that grade, David had suggested to her, let's get a couple of things in your name. And it was in process, or she would never have been able to get it. Or at least it would have taken a lot longer. And you need the thing, you need access almost immediately. That's the problem, is you need immediately to be able to get that. So that's our point, is that we need to consider that the wives find out how they can do it and then get credit for their name.
Those of you that have a joint account with both of your names on it, you might want to inquire of the bank that credit card is from and see what they would do in the event of your husband's death. Would they let you continue that in your own name? And I'd get that in writing, not just get it over the telephone. Okay, let's talk a little bit about life insurance. Under the Navigators group plan with Metropolitan, during your working lifetime, is this plugged in? Thank you, Jerry. Yes, we'll get to that in just a moment. We're going to talk about life insurance first. And there's nothing in your notebook on life insurance, but the section we'll be looking at in the notebook this morning is the Medicare and health plan supplement section. During your working lifetime, up to age 65, your basic coverage under the group plan with Metropolitan is $50,000. Now, some of you may also have some optional insurance coverage, and we're not going to deal with that this morning because that varies. You can have anywhere from $25,000 to $150,000 of the optional coverage, but we're just going to look at the basic coverage. At age 65, if you are still actively serving full-time staff with the Navigators, this $50,000 reduces to $32,500. At age 70, if you're still serving full-time, how did I do that? It's 70. Thank you, Jerry. The coverage reduces to $25,000. And that will remain in effect as long as you are serving full time. When you begin drawing your pension, whether you have limited assignment or are fully retired, the amount of insurance available to you changes, and all of this is gone. You then have available $5,000 of coverage for each of you. That's $5,000 for the husband and $5,000 for the wife. That's basically a burial policy to cover burial expenses. I failed to mention that that while you're serving full time, the policy also provides $5,000 of coverage for your spouse. And you may also have an additional $5,000 of optional coverage on your spouse.
Is that maintained?
Pardon me?
Is that maintained regardless of age?
Yes, for the spouse. Yes. Now, after you retire, after you start drawing your pension, then this coverage becomes optional. You can continue $5,000 of coverage for the husband, or you can continue $5,000 coverage for the wife. You can continue none of it if you don't need it, or you can continue all of it. It's strictly your choice. The current year premium on this is $15.30 a month for the retired employee, whether that's male or female. Gender makes no difference on this. The premium for the spouse is $5.37 a month. So to continue, excuse me, this is incorrect. This is $10.30. Is that right, Jerry? Pardon me? $15.30, okay. Let me start over here. Excuse me. $15.30 for the retired employee, $5.37 for the spouse. So if you want to continue both of these coverages after you start drawing your pension, this is what the monthly premium will be at current rates. One of the things that's been happening on our life insurance rates is that they've been going down each year because the age mix of our staff is going down. You know, when we have new staff come on, they're typically in their 20s and 30s. And so the more younger people you get in the group, then that brings those premiums down a bit. So it could be a little bit less. It could be a little bit more in a few years. Life insurance rates don't jump around the way health insurance rates do. So they're a little bit more steady. And I wanted you to know just what you can anticipate in life insurance from the Navigators when you get your pension started. Yes? It can be deducted from your pension payment if you want to. Otherwise, you could send us a check every month. Yes. Are there any other questions on the life insurance? Okay. Let's go on to Medicare, and we'll begin with the material that's in your notebook now. Yes.
Some of us can term with the care minister's life.
Mm-hmm.
And even though that does start decreasing at 65, we can still maintain that with them. Is that checked out?
Yes, you can. You can continue any coverage you have with Presbyterian minister's life after you retire, if you have a policy that's still in effect at that time. And what you would begin doing then, since those premiums are presently paid by payroll deduction, we wouldn't have any payroll deduction, so you would need to pay the premium directly to PMF at that time. Okay, you become eligible for Medicare at age 65. And that doesn't mean you have to sign up at 65. That just means that's when you're eligible. If your spouse is younger than 65, when you reach your 65th birthday, then he or she will not yet be eligible. There's no Medicare coverage prior to age 65 unless you want to pay a very high premium for it. I don't have the premium with me, but it seems to me like it's in the neighborhood of $200 a month. So you'd have to be pretty desperate and have no other insurance available if you were going to go that route. If you're...
On the second paragraph, your spouse is on Medicare at age 65, provided you are eligible. In some cases, when the wife is older than the husband, can you tell us how...
Yes, that's what I was going to get into. If the wife is older, or the spouse who's not the Navigator employee is older, then he or she would be eligible for Medicare at age 65 if you are at least age 62. You become eligible for Social Security benefits at age 62. And if a non-working spouse or a spouse who is not the wage earner wants to be covered by Medicare, is 65 and you're at least 62, then they could begin that coverage at that time. Yes, that's true. Just has to be eligible for Social Security benefits, not necessarily drawing Social Security benefits. If you are still serving full-time with the Navigators beyond age 65, you do not need to sign up for Medicare at that time. You can if you want to. I'm not sure there's really much advantage to doing that because the health insurance with the Navigators is still going to be primary. And you would also have to pay a monthly premium to Medicare for that coverage. Now, you'll see information in the newspaper occasionally and in various articles about Medicare that tell you if you don't sign up at age 65, if you delay, then you'll have to pay a higher premium. You'll have to pay a penalty of 10% a year. There is an exception to that, and that is if you are still covered by an employer-sponsored health insurance plan, such as our plan with Metropolitan, that penalty will not apply. You would simply need to enroll in Medicare as soon as you discontinue your active full-time service with the Navigators. Did you follow that? That you'll see that in the press occasionally. There'll be articles saying if you're eligible for Medicare this year, sign up, because if you don't, you'll have to pay a penalty. And unless the law changes, and there hasn't been any discussion that I'm aware of changing that particular aspect of the law, things will just continue as they are. You won't need to sign up right away, and you won't have to pay a penalty.
If we keep having insurance, does that mean we would still have to sign up on retirement for Medicare to avoid that penalty?
Yes. Yes. We'll get into that in a few minutes. There are two parts to Medicare. The first part is hospital insurance that pays some of your hospitalization costs. And the second part is the supplementary medical insurance, Part B, which covers physicians and surgeons' fees. There is no cost to you for Part A. The Social Security taxes that those who are earning an income are paying really pay the premium for Part A of Medicare. So the Social Security taxes that you are presently paying are paying the Part A Medicare premium for people who are presently enrolled in Medicare. That's just part of the way the tax is set up. So there's no additional cost to you after you start drawing Social Security. It does not fully cover hospitalization, no. Part A, it covers some hospitalization, yes. If we go down here to the bottom of the page, that paragraph numbered one, there is a $520 deductible on Medicare for each hospital admission. And then the costs for the next 60 days of care are covered. Now, those are approved costs. So you could have, say, $5,000 in actual charges. Medicare might approve $3,000 of those and then pay 80% of what they approve. So it would pay only $2,400, less your $520 deductible. So it's very limited coverage. After 60 days in the hospital, you have 30 more days, but you have to pay the first $130 for the days, for the next 30 days.
Per day.
Is this 1 year at a time relevant? Yes. Each calendar year is a separate benefit period. Now, this would be true. No, excuse me. On the Part A, this is for each hospitalization. So you could be hospitalized early in the year, go through all this once, later in the year, and go through it all again. Okay. After 90 days, you have a lifetime reserve of 60 days that you can draw on. You don't have to do that. You can if you want to. Once you use that 60-day lifetime reserve, that cannot be replenished. It's used and it's gone. Medicare also provides some skilled nursing facility benefits. If you're transferred to a skilled nursing facility within 30 days after a hospital stay of at least 3 days, then you pay nothing for the first 20 days, and then for the next 80 days you pay $65, and then after 100 days there are no benefits. And for this purpose, a benefit period is a calendar year. There are some home health services covered, some hospice benefits, some psychiatric hospital benefits. And in certain instances, Medicare will pay benefits in a non-participating hospital. If you are planning a hospital admission and you are covered by Medicare, Medicare is your primary coverage after retirement, then you will want to know before you are admitted if that hospital is a Medicare participating hospital. The instance when benefits would be paid for a non-participating hospital would be if you're treated in an emergency and the closest hospital where you can be treated is a non-participating hospital, then Medicare will pay some benefits for that treatment. They also expect you to be transferred to a participating hospital as soon as you're able to be transferred. Are there any questions on the Part A? Well, I have mixed feelings about that kind of thing. we'll get into how the health insurance with Metropolitan supplements Medicare in a few minutes. And the way the two work together, it's going to cover virtually all of your medical expenses. So what that kind of policy would provide would just, if you're in the hospital, it's just some extra cash. So you would need to decide if it's worth it to pay the premium for that.
Right.
Yes. Well, we'll get to that in a little bit. That's not quite true, Elvin.
The hospital insurance doesn't cost anything in Medicare.
That's true.
Can you sign up for that without signing up for the second part at age 65?
You can sign up for one, for either Part A or Part B without the other one, but I'm not sure which way it works. It should be in this booklet here.
It doesn't cost you anything. And you can do that without taking the second one, so do it. Because then you'd be covered and it wouldn't cost you anything. But they may tie the second one in.
Okay, so that would mean that you can get Part A without Part B. You can get Part A without Part B on page 12 in this in the booklet. There's a little booklet in your notebook on Medicare. And it says, unless you tell, you will, when you become eligible for hospital insurance, you're also covered by supplementary medical insurance, which is Part B, unless you tell the Social Security Administration you do not want it. You may drop out at any time. Now, there's some consequences to doing that, and we'll get into that pretty soon. The cost each month for the Part B is $17.90. In the second paragraph under Part B, under who is eligible, cross out that second paragraph. That was 1986 law, and I just failed to note that had changed in 1987. cross off the second part under who is eligible on page 3. The second paragraph under Part B, if you aren't eligible for monthly Social Security benefits, cross that out. Okay. The cost for Part B is $17.90 a month, and they just deduct that from your Social Security check when you sign up. Yes. Pardon me? Yes. Yes. And then this next paragraph just emphasizes what I mentioned earlier. If there's a delay from the time you leave active full-time employment before you begin Medicare, then you'll pay a higher premium for Part B. If you begin that immediately after you sever your full-time employment relationship with the navigators, then there will be no penalty. You can enroll within a seven-month period, and that seven-month period begins 3 months before you retire and ends 4 months after you retire. The benefits under Part B, you pay the first $75 of recognized charges. Now, this is a calendar year deductible on this rather than for each incident. And then medical insurance pays 80% of the recognized charges. And again, that doesn't mean 80% of all of the charges. That means 80% of the charges recognized by Medicare. There's an enumeration here of services that are covered by Medicare and then mention of certain services which are limited, which have some limited coverage. Okay, now we're going to talk about how Medicare and our health insurance with Metropolitan coordinate. After you begin drawing your pension, Medicare becomes the primary coverage, and the coverage with Metropolitan would then be secondary. You have an option on whether to continue that coverage with Metropolitan. You are not required to, but you can do so. If you do continue, then your expenses would be submitted first to Medicare, and then after Medicare has paid benefits, you would then need to submit copies of the bills and a copy of the Medicare Statement of Benefits attached to one of those blue Metropolitan claim forms and submit that to the Staff Benefits Department so that the expenses could then be the remaining expenses could be covered by Metropolitan. So if you don't have Medicare after retirement, then that eliminates you from participating in the Navigator's health insurance plan, because after retirement, that is a Medicare supplement. Are there any questions on that? Yes, and I'll get to that in just a minute, Jack. They will send it to the hospital if you assign benefits to the hospital. Okay. After you retire, if either spouse is under age 65, then the Metropolitan Health Insurance is going to remain primary for that individual up to age 65. Those of you, I know there's several of you whose wives are a few years younger, and so if you retire at 65, Medicare will become primary for you, but Metropolitan will continue just as it presently does for your wife until she's also 65. The pension trust will pay part of the Metropolitan premium for you. If you have 20 years of service or more with the Navigators, then the premium is going to be $30 for the part paid by the pension trust is going to be $30 for the husband and $30 for the wife of the Metropolitan premium. If you have less than 20 years of service, you can figure how much the pension trust will pay by multiplying your years of service times $1.50. So if you have 10 years of service, then the pension trust will pay $15 of the premium.
Is that stated in these notes?
That is not in these notes, no. That's true. That's right. That's after you both reach 65. As long as one of you is under 65, then the premium is going to be the current premium for a couple, which is, I don't have that. Yes, yes. Without deducting that? Well, if both of you are over 65 this year, it would be $51.05 apiece. If one of you is under 65, the premium is in the neighborhood of $120. Can you remember what that is on your... I don't have that with me. I'm sorry. I forgot to pick that up this morning. But it will depend on the premium at the time at the time you retire, and we'll go into this in detail with you at the time so that you know exactly what the costs are going to be. But I do want you to make a note that the pension trust does pay up to $60 of the premium for a couple if you have 20 or more years of service. Now, if you choose not to participate in the Medicare, in the Metropolitan Health Insurance Program, you have some other kind of Medicare supplement that you prefer, you can certainly do that, and the pension trust will still pay part of the premium for that. It's not limited just to the Metropolitan plan. Any kind of Medicare supplement, the pension trust will help you with the premium. I want to show you an illustration of how the benefits are coordinated between Medicare and Metropolitan after Medicare becomes primary. And we're going to go through what would happen if you had, in this example, three claims during the year. And we'll assume that your first claim is $150. We'll assume that Medicare has paid $40 of this. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. So that leaves $110 that have been unpaid. When this claim comes into Metropolitan showing the $150 expense, the $40 paid by Medicare, Metropolitan starts with this $150, not with the $110 that's remaining. So in this case, there would be no benefits paid because this $150 would meet the deductible for the year. Are there any questions so far? Yes. But your full deductible is satisfied even though you've only paid $110 out of your pocket because your total expenses have been $150. Now let's assume your second claim is $100 and Medicare pays $80. That leaves $20. You've satisfied your deductible. So Metropolitan looks at this $100 and says, well, they've satisfied their deductible. They're entitled to 80% of this from Metropolitan. So the metropolitan benefit in this case would be $80. Your total claims for the year have been $250. The total that you're entitled to of that is $80. That does not exceed this $110 that you've already paid out of your pocket, so they pay you the full $80. So on this claim, you would, in essence, have been paid $160. You were paid $80 by Medicare. You were paid $80 by Metropolitan. But part of this $80 is going back to reimburse you for part of your deductible. Is that confusing enough? It gets better. What? Right. Yeah, I see you guys just sort of sitting there like this. Okay. We get to the third claim, and the third claim is $1,000. Medicare pays $800, leaving $200. So your total expenses up to this time, I'm going to get another sheet here. The total expenses up to this time have been $1,250. From the $150 on the first claim, $100 on the second claim, and $1,000 on the third. Your $150 deductible with Metropolitan is subtracted from that. That leaves $1,100 that Metropolitan can consider. 80% of that is $880. That means that on these three claims, you can be reimbursed up to $880. Now what they do at this point is they look at these total expenses of $1,250, subtract what you've been reimbursed by Medicare, which is a total of $920. That leaves $320. And they can pay you the lesser of either this amount here or the amount remaining that you have not already been reimbursed. You've already been reimbursed $80 by Metropolitan. That leaves $240. That does not exceed the amount of benefits available to you, so you get this full $240. Now, the result of that is that from Medicare, you've been paid, I have to go back to the first claim here. If you can follow this, you're doing really well. Medicare has paid $40 on the first claim. They paid $80 on the second, and $800 on the third. So there's a total of $920 from Medicare. You've also been paid by Metropolitan none on the first claim, because that was the one that satisfied your Metropolitan deductible. On the second claim, $80, and on the third claim, $200. I subtracted wrong someplace here. This should have been $250 down here. So the total of this is your total, the total of what you have been reimbursed is your total $1,250. And the point that I want you to understand here is that between Medicare and Metropolitan, after Medicare is primary, you're going to be, in most instances, reimbursed for the full amount of your medical expenses. You won't have any out-of-pocket expenses the way they work together. That's right. But you got to be sick to get it. Well, we didn't take into consideration any Medicare deductibles here, just for illustration purposes. It just makes the illustration a little bit easier. But that would be considered by Metropolitan. This, we looked at this as if they were all Part B expenses. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Metropolitan begins with the full amount of the costs, not with what's left after Medicare pays. And it's because they start with the full amount of the costs that you can get the 100% reimbursement. You can't get more than 100%, but you can get 100%. Yes. Yes, you can carry it for life. Yeah. No, it's. Yeah. I know what you're talking about, the continuation of benefits for. As long as you can afford the premium. But if you have very many medical expenses, that's going to be your only health-related expense. And after you retire, because that premium is coming out of your pocket rather than being paid as a ministry expense, that premium is going to be a tax-deductible expense under current law. Tax-deductible. Yes. Yes, it is. Well, it's unusual for the health insurance to be available for life after retirement. There are some employers, some of the really large employers do that, you know, with thousands and thousands of employees. But it's certainly not the norm. They wouldn't have the same coordination of benefits. If you look into other Medicare supplements, you'll want to keep that in mind, that you may find something that has a lower premium, but you're not going to have that kind of coordination of benefits, so that if you buy a separate Medicare supplement that's just an individual policy, in most cases, the expenses that are going to be considered under that policy are going to be the total less what Medicare paid. They won't start with the total expenses like this does. Yeah.
Hillary, this is the big gap thing. Is, you know, on the national scene now. Uh-huh. The president's trying to get through.
Yeah.
It's debilitating to the income.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let me ask another question now. In that, what if you do have another supplement insurance?
Well,
pay or not pay?
It'll depend on what that policy says. If it does not limit the benefits to expenses not covered by other insurance, then it would just be additional money that would come to you. But it really, if you want to buy something in addition to these, be sure it's going to pay you something before you pay the premium. Are there any other questions on this? Yes, Jack. The pension would continue, and the part of the health insurance premium that's paid by the pension trust would still be paid. This group plan with Metropolitan would go out of existence. Yeah. The pension trust is a separate legal entity from the Navigators. You know, if someone sues the Navigators and we end up with a large award or something like that, that cannot touch the pension trust. It's not subject to any kind of suit against the Navigators. It's not subject to any kind of financial claim against the organization. because it's a separate entity. On the trustees, the board of directors. Yes. Yeah. One of the laws that governs pension trusts and things of that nature requires that investments be diversified to some extent. And Jerry has a lot more knowledge on the investments and the way the trust operates than I do. But you can't put all your eggs in one basket. There were things happening where an employer would fund a pension plan completely with their own stock, and then if the company went down, the pension trust went along with it. So you can't do that anymore. Any other questions? That would be taxable income. I'm glad you brought that up. When you get your W-2P at the end of the year, which is equivalent to the W-2 you get as an active employee, that $30 medical premium benefit would be included in your total taxable income. Any other questions? Okay. Did you want to take a short break, Jerry?
Let's just stand up for a couple of minutes. Stand up and stretch.
Okay, let's take our seats. Would you want to stick your nose out there and say back in?
Night, I just go ahead and do it just so I can sleep. Yeah. It's dryness, really.
I've got a couple of ideas I've been thinking about since last night. I'd like to talk with you about maybe more morning.
Okay.
On some revisions in the lineup.
Good. I've always liked it for 2 days. is not really part of the constituency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of people, but not different from the last one. Mm-hmm. Not that the last one wasn't good, it really was. It's just that, well, some of it's the people, and some of it's just the word's gotten out, and mm-hmm. that, hey, this is a communication information, and like Jack said, because we, I try to emphasize with people, you don't know how much the values have done for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Jack brought it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it, like if I say the concluding remarks, which it might be good, Jim's deal and all or something, I'd just like to bring you up again. Mm-hmm. You know, if you check other organizations, you'll think, thanks for all of these people we met here. You know. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to, let's see, I guess we've still got about three people missing. Okay, we'll give a couple more minutes here to get things going. Okay, you can turn in your books to the tab that says Lifestyle and Housing, and you can turn immediately past first three pages. We're just going to skip that because I've already covered some of that already in the first session because of the necessity of doubling up. And the first page that will be in your notebook is entitled Housing. 80% of retirees end up staying, so forth. But before we get to that, I'd like to piggyback on some information that Russ gave us last night to help us, because what we have sources of income that Hilda has presented. We have the budget that you will have worked out using the suggestions that Russ gave you or whatever type of budgeting you use. And then there may or may not be a gap between the budget and the sources of income. And so what you need to do is to begin to prepare and provide for that. Another thing that he mentioned last night was do your budgeting in 1987 dollars. However, your benefits are calculated or projected through to your 65th birthday, and depending on how far away you are from your 65th birthday tells you how realistic those are. So I want to show you how you can pull those back to 1987 figures. But first of all, there are a couple of terms that would be good for you to learn, just like interest rates and principal and interest and taxes and insurance and things like this. One is present value of money, or PV as it's called, and the second is future value, or FV, of money. And what these terms simply mean is, for example, let's take this illustration. Let me give you some assumptions. Let's assume that you're age 59 at this time. Your wife is the same age. You're going to commence receiving your benefits from the Navigators at 65. Now, you're going to still be, smoke's going to still be coming out of your mouth. But you've decided, like Roy Robertson, to start getting your benefits at 65. Your wife's life expectancy at that point is 19 more years to age 84. And so it'd be good to plan, if you need to supplement the NAB pension and Social Security, to plan to supplement that for a period of 19 years. That's why I have this from age 65 to age 84. In fact, if you want to be conservative, you'd want to project that out, you know, a few more years. But that's up to you. And I'm going to assume that from age 59 out here until age 65, that the inflation rate is going to be 3%. And the reason I'm assuming that is because that's the figure that Hilda used in increasing your wage base for the pension plan. However, once I reach 65 to 84, I'm going to be a little bit more conservative and take Russ's 35-year average, and I'm going to project inflation at 4% at that point. Then I'm going to have an interest rate of 8% that any money that you have saved and you're going to draw out is going to earn 8%, which is going to give you a real return of 4%. In other words, if inflation is 4%, you're earning 8%. The difference is the real rate of return. For example, back in the days when you could get 4.75% mortgages, you know, 30 years ago, inflation was essentially zero at that time. The real rate of return on money generally hovers around 4%. Now, the question is, I'm going to have so much money per month to supplement my NAV pension and Social Security. So in order to have that come in for the next 19 years, how much do I need to have accumulated by the time I'm 65? And that figure becomes the present value of all of these payments. In other words, the present value is the lump sum amount that you have to have in order to receive a certain monthly payout per month. It is not just, let's say that's $200 a month. It is not just $200 times 19 years. The reason for that is because this lump sum of money that you have is going to be earning that 8% interest, and the balance, the residual balance, is going to continue to earn that. That's why this curve kind of comes down like this, until theoretically, you know, when the last of the two of you dies in 19 years, that supplement has reduced to zero. That would be the theory of the thing. Now, okay, once I know how much I need when I'm 65, then the next question is, how much do I need to save each month in order to attain that amount of money? Now we're looking at this same amount of money from back here at age 59, so now that becomes the future value. So how much money do I need to save each month in order to accumulate this amount of money? Does that make sense on that? That's the exercise that you want to go through. That's why you know, you need a financial advisor unless you're really into this kind of thing. Now, I happen to have a calculator, and mine is a little bit out of date. But, for example, these white buttons are just the usual arithmetic functions that you can do on any $5 calculator. These black keys up here are the business functions. And, for example, here's the number of years or months, the periods. Here's the interest rate. Here's the present value of money. Here's the future value of money. And here's the monthly payment. And by knowing how to work this calculator, well, you can figure all of this. And so you either need to be aware of this stuff and have the calculator, or plugged in to a financial advisor who can do this. All I want to do today is not to teach you how to do it. It's just to give you some vocabulary so that when you go and talk to the financial advisor, it'll make a little bit of sense to you. Now, any questions on the future value and present value of the money? The future value, in the illustration, this is not the only use of these terms, but in our situation, the future value is the lump sum you want to accumulate as of the day you start needing it, and then as you just switch your perspective and begin to view this as a payout, that same amount of money becomes the present value. Okay, now, another thing in your planning, any of you, and most of you have done planning, strategic planning, and you know that you always make assumptions, planning assumptions, when you do your planning. So these are the assumptions that, again, commence benefits at 65 years of age, the wife's life expectancy, and I've chosen that because statistically she will outlive the man, is 19 years. The consumer price index in these 6 years from 59 to 65, 3%. Consumer price index increase during the retirement years is 4%, and the interest rate is 8%. I have further, now these, I have made some assumptions here, but you can put in your real figures. I assumed the person was going to get $1,400 from a NAP pension. When I was working this out earlier this morning, I didn't have the benefit of Hilda's input in it, and I assumed a primary Social Security benefit of $700, which would give the wife's half of that of $350. Hilda said that given this NAP pension of $1,400, that a more likely Social Security benefit might be more around $900. So I put those figures in red. So the $1,400, the $900, and the $450 comes out with a figure of $2,750 that you're going to get 6 years from now. So the question is, how much, if you're going to look at your budget, remember Russ said make your budget out of $1987 dollars. Well, you can't compare a 1987 budget with a 1993 income. And so, again, using the calculator, the present value of the benefits, the $2,750, if you pull that back to 1987 dollars, you come out with about $2,300. That's the figure you use to compare with your expenditure budget. Now, you don't have to have the fancy calculator to do this particular one. What you can do is start with $2,750 with your $5 Japanese calculator and punch in 0.97 because you're going to reduce it 3% a year. Punch in 0.97, and then you multiply that by 2750, and then whatever answer you get, you multiply that by 0.97, and you do that 6 times, and you will get essentially the same answer as I've got here with the fancy calculator.
You got smoke on
the calculator. Yeah. Do you understand that? You just take your interest or your percentage assumption here and deduct that from 100. In this case, it's 3%, so you end up 97%. And then the number of years that you're pulling back to. In other words, the number of years between when you plan to start drawing the benefits and your current age. In the illustration, it's 6 years. Now, you won't come out with exactly the same figure, but it's close enough that it will help you. And it's very crucial that you go through that step, because otherwise you're not comparing apples and oranges, you're comparing apples and baseballs. I mean, they're just not even in the same park. See? So it's very crucial you make that step. Once you have made this step to come back to here, and I have assumed, again, a budget of $2,450. Now, your budget, your real budget, which you have worked out, maybe less than $2,300, and you breathe a sigh of relief and praise God. Or it may be like my assumption here, you come out $150 a month short. So how are you going to get that $150? Well, then you go to your financial advisor and you say, I'm going to need $150 a month for 19 years. I'm 59 years old right now. Let's assume you have no other investments, no TSA, no IRA, no apartment house back in your hometown that you're renting out or anything. So you go to your advisor and you say, I'm going to need $150 a month for my 19 years. I'm 59 years of age now. How much do I have to set aside for the next 6 years in order to have that amount of money, remembering that these two are the same figures, just looked at from different perspectives. And he will tell you, and in this case, if you had nothing, you'd probably have to set aside about $250 a month for 6 years in order to have $150 a month for 19 years. Now, if you have had a tax-sheltered annuity or an IRA or some other investment plan, you may already have that $150. But remember, you remember the statement that Russ made about remember the power of compound interest and whatever the statement he attributed to Einstein. But what you do is you invest this money, you get it working for you, earning more money. That's why I said you invest $250 a month for 6 years, and you'll get $150 a month for 19 years, and you can readily sense, without going through the mathematics on that, that you are investing a lot less than you're going to get back over the 19 years. And the reason, the difference in that is the interest that the money is earning here and the interest that it continues to earn as it's being paid out to you. It's important to remember that in both the accumulation phase and the payout phase, your interest is working for you. Any question on that? You confused? Okay. All I want you to do, as I say, is just to help you to be a little bit conversant with your financial advisor so he doesn't do a snow job on you and you come out, all you do is just tell me where to sign. Because you don't want to find yourself in that kind of a predicament. Just be able to interact with him knowledgeably to some degree. Another thing I would suggest, Russ mentioned last night that most financial advisors, financial planners as they're called these days, have investment or insurance products to sell. And obviously there's a conflict of interest built into that situation. And I don't know where you go to find somebody who doesn't have that, because I don't know any financial planner that works with individuals like us who doesn't end up making his livelihood by selling the products. Because if he just charged you a consulting fee, he couldn't make a living because people couldn't afford to pay the fees that he would have to charge. Now, there are a lot of consultants to businesses, you know, that are charging $1,000 to $5,000 a day because businesses can and will pay that kind of thing. We are going through an exercise, or will be going through an exercise, to reevaluate our health insurance program. And we're going to pay a consulting firm somewhere between $5,000 and $7,000. And this is a completely independent, standalone, no products to sell, no conflict of interest type of a consulting arrangement. And when we are spending $1.2 million a year on health insurance premiums, we can afford to pay $5,000 to $7,000 to make sure that we're getting the best deal. But you're not going to go and pay somebody $500 to $1,000 to evaluate your life insurance plan. You're going to go to somebody who's going to evaluate it and say, here, I think you've got product A, but I really think you ought to have product B because I sell it. And I don't know how to work around that other than go to two or three different planners, you know, and get their input. But just keep in mind that whenever you go to a planner, there's as honest as they are, and some of you are working with planners that are your friends and your Christians and so forth, but there is that built-in conflict of interest. Any question on that aspect of it? Okay, let's shift gears for just a few minutes.
This financial advisor would Russ be that then and was stuck with his offer last night? Is that the sort of person you're talking about? Somebody who knows this kind of stuff and could lead you through the exercise?
Well, Russ could certainly do the exercises that I've talked to you about this morning. I could do that kind of thing. When it comes to telling you, though, what you ought to do to close the gap, either Russ or I could just give you various possibilities, but we're not really, well, Russ may be. I'm certainly not attuned to all the various vehicles that are out there, and I absolutely do not give investment advice. I mean, that's just a cardinal principle with me, that I do not give investment advice. Oh, there are all kinds of investment advisors out there. Yes. Well, generally, for example, he may say, well, I think you ought to use mutual fund A. Now, it so happens that mutual fund A has an 8% sales charge, which he gets most of. And that's how he gets remunerated for giving you that advice. Now, mutual fund B may have as good a track record and performance record, but it has no sales charge. But he's certainly not going to direct you to mutual fund B because he gets... There may be, Eileen, but I'm not aware, as I say, because... Pardon? We couldn't afford them. The people that can afford them are the wealthy people.
Okay, so the people out there who have their own best interests at heart, people that we can't afford, so it looks like we're kind of in a box here.
Jack?
Gary, let me just bounce this thought up. In a situation that most of us are in, it seems to me that we've got to find somebody, a financial advisor who is selling products, that we trust, we feel we can trust.
Mm-hmm.
Let him give us counsel and advice on getting started in these areas of investment. But we've got to do our own research. We've got to do some studying on it. We've got to learn and become knowledgeable of this stuff. And then as time goes by and we see what he is doing, we make comparisons.
Yes.
And we become more knowledgeable. And then we may find other products that are better for us,
mm-hmm.
because of our own research.
Right.
We get into it a little bit at a time rather than trying to jump in the deep end all at once.
Yeah.
Don't you think
that's... Yes. Yeah. And, you know, there are people out there that would have, would seek to have your best interest at heart, but even there, he may be representing products. In other words, he may put you into the best product he has that he represents, but it may not be the best product that's available or suitable for you.
But until we can determine what that is,
yeah.
You know, we kind of got to go with what he said at first.
Yeah, that's right.
When I were talking about cost of peace of mind, I mean, some of it is just, you just
have to do something. Yeah. Well, there's a problem here that we don't have a solution for. I mean, you know, all I can do is just tell you what the problem is.
Well, I think something that Russ mentioned last night in financial management is, you know, just a good suggestion, be very selective about investment advice. If at all possible, test your advisor first with a small amount of money for a number of years. Well, we may not have a number of years, but still.
Yeah.
Not just everything.
Right. Jack and I know a, quote, fine Christian investment manager who has lost hundreds of thousands of dollars for Christian clients.
I know something like that too.
Okay. Okay. Let's shift gears. And again, we want to help you all we can, but on this investment advice, we just reach a point where we can't go any farther. Okay. If I thought you were making an unwise decision, I would say that to you, yes. I would not mind telling you what I think is an unwise decision. I will not tell you what I think is a wise decision, because as sure as I do that, the next day that particular product will prove me wrong. Okay, let's look at housing. What state has the highest percentage of population who are over 65?
Florida.
Florida. Okay. The state that has the highest percentage of population who are over 65. And you're right, 15.7% of the population in Florida is over 65. What would you guess to be the second state? You have looked at my deal. yeah. Okay, let me show you here. Kansas, Missouri. Note here. On 3 through 8, where are all those states? What's the Midwest wheat corn belt country, see? And I suppose that what this indicates is probably two things. There are not a lot of people moving into those states, but the people who are there are staying. You know, they're still on the farm, kind of a thing. Now, by contrast, Arizona and California, which we think of as retiree states, have lower percentages because, again, not because in raw numbers there are fewer retirees, but because they're offset by a higher percentage of younger people moving into those states. I put Colorado there just in case those of you who are out-of-staters want to come to see us. Why? You can realize they're 8.2% here in the state of Colorado. The point I want to make from this is just to underscore the first paragraph here on this sheet on housing, that 80% of retirees end up staying where they lived prior to retirement. Now, this is true. Let me hasten to say this is true for what I call the active phase. Where's Joyce? Joyce, what were the three words you used?
Young,
retire, middle retire, and older retire. Some, I call it the active, the less active, and the inactive phases.
Smoking, blowing, and
clumping. I'll have to repeat that for the tape. Hey, you know, that's an original, Skip. That wasn't in Reader's Digest. Refirement, okay. Now, many move as they enter the less active, or particularly, of course, the dependent phase. If you stay or move, do so as a result of a deliberate decision, not default. In other words, you think, well, let me just tell you. You know, I look at my house and I look at all of the grass I've got to mow and the flower beds to weed and all that sort of stuff, and I think, boy, I'd like to get into something with less care. And then I immediately begin to think about moving, and I just go, ugh, you know. And the trauma of moving sort of outweighs the chronic trauma, and the acute trauma of moving outweighs the chronic trauma of
the weeds and the grass and shoveling the snow out of the driveway, kind of a thing. Don't fall into that trap. You know, either stay or move because of a deliberate decision, not by default. Now, there are some issues, and they're in your book, but let me just put them up here on the screen. Issues to consider for staying or moving, and obviously, number one is our understanding, our perception of God's will for us. What it is God wants us to do at this particular phase of our lives obviously determines where we live. At least it determines the locale. It may not determine the house or the apartment or the condo type of thing. In, of course, determining God's will, the ministry opportunities, what it is you feel God wants you to do in the way of ministry, if you sort of draw a neutral on that, then you can look at things in terms of cost of living. For example, you might decide that you would prefer all, just as many lost people in Alabama as there are in Colorado, and it costs less to live in Alabama, and so that would be a decision. Where your children and grandchildren are. And I would just say, take that one real seriously. Let me speak as a parent who reared children without the benefit of grandparents. Both of my parents had died before Eleanor and I were married, and Eleanor's mother died within a year after we were married, and then her father moved to Florida. And we felt a real gap in rearing our kids because we didn't have the grandchildren around. And so I would just say to you, you know, I can't speak as a grandparent yet. Some of you can. But take that one seriously. Friends, church, other spiritual and emotional support. We talked about that on Tuesday morning. Climate. What I want to say on the climate is don't assume that the area that you enjoyed when you were there on vacation is the place that you're going to enjoy 12 months a year. I mentioned the Arizona thing as a case in point. In January, it was lovely. It's beginning to get unlovely. Am I right, Arizona? Maybe Arizona's okay. It's Florida that I can't stand in the summertime. Your health and physical strength, how long you want to shovel snow, or whatever, you know. On the next page, and we won't take time to do this now, but there's what I call a stay-go test. And you can work through this. What I would suggest is you work through it individually and then get together and compare your notes on it and see, hopefully you will line up pretty good. If you decide to stay in your present city, is your house the best for retirement? Is it too large or too small? Maintenance, furnace, so forth. In other words, these are some issues that you just need to consider. And then finally, the next area, and I want to stop here in about 1 minute. It's just the types of housing to consider, the single family, the condo, the mobile home park, and the retirement communities are various options. And then important cautions about moving and advising. On number A, get good legal advice, add and tax advice. I learned just this week, you know, that all of us, Hilda and Jesse accepted here, but all of us are in the age bracket where we are eligible for that capital gains exemption on the sale of our home, you know, up to, what is it, $150,000 on the sale. I learned just this week, though, that in order to take advantage of that, you have to have owned that house for 3 years. And some people have gotten trapped on that because, like, they were an executive of a company and they made that move just before retirement, and then 2 years later they retired and go to sell their house, and lo and behold, find out that they're not eligible for that $150,000 exemption. And that could happen in the Navigators because of our moving around here and there. So get good tax advice. And, you know, if you find that you're moving, and I'm not sure, and I'm not qualified to give tax advice, but this is why you'd have to go to a tax advisor, it might be worth your while to sit on that house for a time, even after you moved, before you sell it, in order to qualify for that capital gains exemption. That just illustrates my point. Usually when you would go to an attorney for selling the house, all he's going to be concerned with is the transfer of the title and the closing costs and that kind of thing. Unless he is a tax attorney, he probably will not consider that factor for you. If you ask him, he may. So you may get the tax advice from this same person, from the attorney, but if you don't feel he's really into that, then go to your tax advisor.
Of course, to get that kind of capital gain, I have to have the property quite a while, unless you're in California, and then you've got it back from here to get it.
Well, that's true, yes. I'll just hold on to this. Okay, the last page in this section are just some issues for you to consider regarding condo living, because I know that if you're like me, you consider that at some time or other. You want to punt the mowing the grass and all that stuff. Skip, you have experienced this. Have you had a chance to look over this sheet? You have any comments on it? You really did date yourself with that. Stereo now is the term, Skipper. Yeah. Now, let me say in response to that particular complaint, there are condo, adult-only condo areas, like there's one up here on the hill, this next to Kissing Camels up there. I can't remember the name of it. Next to, yeah. But these are issues to consider. Okay.
If you look at a condo, I would suggest you look at one that has a garage attached rather than a living room attached.
Yeah.
And then they get attached that way.
Good. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Well, have questions on this. We can discuss it at coffee break. Let me say one final. I did realize I had an announcement. Don't forget your evaluations, and I would...